Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about how writing works, how writers work, and how the best writers risk being strange. I'm thrilled to talk to Ryan North, somebody I've been following for a long time, who's doing a lot of really cool things. So I'll try to not be too wound up in the kind of stuff that I was into when I first kind of encountered your work, but I do want to, and we'll kind of get towards the present and all the stuff you got going on now, but I want to start with kind of where I kind of first encountered you, of course, was probably a lot of people, Dinosaur Comics, which I just, you know, started getting sent as text messages to my phone.
Oh, thank you.
Which is really great. if you could just talk a little bit about, just by way of introduction, to like who you are and what you do for people who don't know your work. I think an interesting place to start is maybe Dinosaur Comics, but I'd be curious to know what you kind of were doing before that. And sort of how you came into Dinosaur Comics and a little bit of the Wild West early days of the internet there, because you were really on the cusp of a couple little things like web comics really starting to boom. And then when the Kickstarter boom started to come in, I mean, I was one of the backers of your original Your To Be or Not To Be Kickstarter, which, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe at the time was the biggest Kickstarter ever.
Biggest publishing project.
Publishing project at the time. Now, of course, at the time, yes. Sanderson has kind of eclipsed that in some ways.
He took it over.
But, you know, that was, to this day, that remains one of the most impressive Kickstarter projects. I'd be curious to know a little bit more. I mean, and that book is really something that I love, and I teach that book in university classes from time to time. So I kind of would like maybe if you could just talk a little bit about Dinosaur Comics, what sort of led you there, and then what kind of led you from Dinosaur Comics to Be or Not to Be before we get into kind of more what you've been doing recently.
Yeah, that's a big question. So hi, everyone. I'm Ryan. I'm a cartoonist, and I got my start with a webcomic called Dinosaur Comics, and that is a comic where it is the same pictures, the same six panels every day, and I just change the words. And normally when I describe that, I say it's better than it sounds because it sounds horrible, but I put in different words. The strange secret origin is I wanted to be a cartoonist. I'd read a lot of indie comics. I didn't somehow realize that comic writer was a job. I thought you had to do it all. And so my hack was, okay, what if I just get these pictures once, this dinosaur clip art, and I'll reuse it and I don't have to draw. And perhaps surprisingly, that worked out pretty well. And so I kept doing Dinosaur Comics. I did this in my last year of undergrad, did it through my grad degree. And then when I graduated, I had a choice between getting a real job, being a computational linguist, or being a cartoonist. And to become a full-time web cartoonist, all I had to do was fail to get a job. And that was really easy to do. So sort of slid into it really nicely. No quitting your day job moment. And it's funny you mentioned Dinosaur Comics starting at this really important time in webcomics, because when I started in 2003, people were already saying, oh, if you want to start a webcomic, you should have started in 1997 with Penny Arcade. That's when the real sweet spot was. But the internet has obviously changed since then. People don't really visit websites anymore. They visit one of five websites filled with screenshots of the other four websites. And we all talk less about comics and songs and music and more about content as a fungible thing that fills an empty vessel. And it really, I pull my hair out about it. But I kept doing the webcomic. And then at a certain point, I had written a choose your own path version of Shakespeare and put that on Kickstarter. And as you say, it did really well. We raised $580,000, which was much more than I expected. We passed our goal in under an hour. It helped that it was a book with illustrations of every ending. So when you lose at the book, which you can in a choose your own path book, instead of feeling like you just lost at reading, you unlock an art gallery. You actually won something. And that helped, I think, propel the Kickstarter initially. And then it sort of became this wonderful little thing where it kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And we kept making the book better and better and better until I ran out of things to do and said, if this reaches 500,000, I will blow up my head. Oh no, I'll literally explode. And then we passed it. And so I had to figure a way to get out of that. And so we 3D printed my head and made a dry ice bomb and blew it up, which I think might be illegal. So don't do that at home.
I remember the distinctly the Kickstarter, the moment where you started running out of things to do. Like you, like I remember distinct, like falling along and like the stretch goals were getting hit so fast. I remember there was a moment where you were communicating with people and you were basically saying like I'm just kind of at this point making it up as I go. Maybe let's have a live, you know, choose your adventure play. I don't know how that'll work, but we'll figure it out.
Yeah,
you know, it was really a wonderful moment, Kickstarter for fans, you know, who were into the book and the idea and so on. I imagine for you it was a kind of a weird combination of stress and joy. Wondering how your result going to work out.
Stress and joy, but also you have, you know, 15,000 people behind you cheering you on. And so it felt like probably the ideal form of a Kickstarter, where you start with the crazy idea that you think only interests you, and then you get a group of people behind you, and together you can do something that you couldn't do on your own. And I think that's the goal, right? That's the dream of crowdfunding. And in that case, it worked out beautifully. It felt like a really, really great experience.
Now, can I just bump back to Dinosaur Comics for just a moment? Had you read the Lynch comic, The Angriest Dog in the World? Is that part of where that came from or no?
So The Angriest Dog in the World by David Lynch, who's, you know, it's a filmmaker. That's three panels with the same drawings. He changes the words. And it's mostly, in my opinion, pun-based, which I love. I remember the first one I saw was someone in the house with The Angriest Dog in the World outside saying, "Who is San Andreas? And why is it all his fault?" I'm like, that's pretty good. And I can tell you that I had not read The Angriest Dog in the World when I started Dinosaur Comics. When I found out about it a few months in, two things happened. One is I had my character T-Rex adopt the angriest dog in the world as his pet, which I thought was a really big power move. To take another author's work and be like, yeah, this is canon to mine now. And the other thing was I realized, because I had this, and still do to some extent, kind of a weird idea about originality, where I can tell you in all honesty, if I had known of The Angriest Dog in the World, I would not have started Dinosaur Comics, because that had been done. And then I would not have had my entire, like, nothing would, whole different life course from that one moment. And it feels crazy to say that, because, you know, there can be two things with the same idea. We want to have adventures in space. We have Star Wars and Star Trek. And obviously what Dinosaur Comics done is very different from what The Angriest Dog in the World did and does. But I guess at the time, and there's still part of me that feels this way, by doing something that no one else has done, at least to your knowledge, it makes it easier to be original in a weird way. Like you don't have anything to compare against.
Or you've got these weird combinations. Like one of the things that I found so brilliant about To Be or Not to Be, just for people who don't know it, as Ryan was saying, it's a choosable path. So it's similar to a choose your own adventure, but legally distinct.
Yes.
and it is a, but it's Hamlet. It's a retelling of Hamlet. And then you've added all sorts of plot into it. Of course, mm-hmm. You've got, like, you can play as Ophelia or read through the book as Ophelia, so on and so forth. What I thought was so brilliant about that initial idea, and one of the reasons I sometimes teach it in my university classrooms, is because, of course, Hamlet is a play that's so thematically obsessed with choice. Yes. And with the question of whether or not a person can act, is it possible to act, both, you know, in terms of dissembling and in terms of taking action. And, you know, here's a person, Hamlet, who's tormented with, you know, what is the difference between, you know, appearance and reality? Is he actually mourning his father if he isn't actually taking action to avenge him, and so on and so forth? It's got all these great thematic resonances in the original play. You're bringing in some respects, your retelling of it in this kind of comical approach includes a lot of both praise and criticism for the original. Mm-hmm. And it constitutes a sort of series of interpretations of the original. But it's also extending that, you know, same thematic idea into the form itself, which is something Shakespeare wasn't as fully doing, of course. And I always thought that was a brilliant, I wasn't surprised the idea caught on in that sense. But it is, as you say, a weird idea, and it has this kind of experimental, I mean, it's a much more comedic angle on things, but it has a certain level of, like, avant-garde structure to it. Yeah. And I'm curious to know kind of where that approach came from, and why you find yourself drawn in some ways to these more unconventional story structures. Because even with Dinosaur Comics, I think one thing that people easily overlook with Dinosaur Comics is how important the form of it is. Yeah. and how carefully constructed those generic panels are.
Yeah, I feel like at heart I am a formalist. I love something that's doing something new with the medium. And I think that is what attracts me both to comics, because it is a younger medium. And my definition of a good comic is a book that has to have amazing story or make you feel something, but also the best comics I've read do something with the form that hadn't been done before. And that's a huge bar to cross. You know, you cross that in comics routinely, you cross that in video games routinely, because both those media are evolving very quickly, but you don't see it a lot in the novel. The novel is pretty well explored territory formally, with the exception of second person nonlinear adventures, because those have traditionally been dismissed as juvenilia. They're for kids. This is not something that adults read because it's inherently goofy. And I disagree. I think like this is fun. And when you do work in a medium that has been dismissed critically, generally, you can do some stuff that hasn't really been done a lot before. There's a neat part in To Be or Not to Be that I reused the same sort of mechanic for the sequel Romeo and or Juliet, where you can unlock a fourth playable character by following a certain path. The book gives you instructions on how to find this character, and it's basically changing the state of the book by changing the state of the reader by telling them information that is hidden in plain sight. So instead of choosing, you know, page 10 for Hamlet or page 20 for Ophelia, add them together, divide by 2, take square root, whatever, this unlocks character 4. And like that feels like a mechanic that should be on the level of the period or the semicolon. Like this is the basic thing you'd want to use while working in this form. A choice is not just letting you explore the narrative space through the story. It's letting you surprise and delight the reader by showing them stuff that is hidden there. Like the whole point of story spaces, choosing your own adventure, in quotes, is to explore and be surprised. And this allows you to do that in a way that is hidden. And I thought that was just such a cute way of sort of expressing what the medium can do through the medium itself. And I chose Hamlet because, like you say, it's a play about choice. It's also the main monologue works is structured like a choice to be or not to be. And finally, the story itself is almost structured like a video game, in that Hamlet begins with a quest to kill the final boss, which is the king. And then he does a bunch of messing around and then finally gets around to killing the final boss, plays over, games over, the end. And so it translated very nicely into a part where you were playing as Hamlet or Ophelia or his dad, King Hamlet, and sort of making your way through that game. So it was a nice marriage of all those things coming together, I think.
Have you seen the book Morlach? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's a graphic novel that was made by Leif Tond, Quebec cartoonist. But Morlach is something I would recommend you try to find if you want. It kind of begins, it's a graphic novel. It begins with this little panel. It's almost like on a 9-panel grid, or it's not quite 9 panels, but it has this sort of square in the beginning. And as Morlach, you know, is, if you're moving from page to page, as the character Morlach is moving through his story, at a certain point, like there's like 2 things he could do. Like he could go left or right, and he goes in both directions, and it starts to like move in this manner. And then like he ends up fighting a ninja and dying in this timeline, and then over in this one he gets reincarnated. And you know, it's really a brilliantly progressive, it's a silent comic, and it kind of moves through all these like strange, again, it has all this video game like path.
Yeah, some, what I always comics, think of, you can see both the choices at once because they're both there on the page.
Exactly. And then he starts to use like the actual geography of like where these things would line up from page to page in interesting ways. Like
gorgeous. One love it.
Person moves. Yeah. At one point they start like overlapping, like one character will go into the next panel, and then now there's 2 of them in the same place, and then they have to have a doubles battle, you know?
Love it. Love it.
Yeah. It's a really brilliant little thing. I was really taken at the time because I think at the time also that book was coming out, people may not remember, but I was doing a PhD around this time. And the sexy thing in like literary studies, it was intertexts and these idea of electronic texts are going to unlock all these different path adventures, and
right,
the kind of book will become nonlinear in many respects. Now, we didn't really see it unfold in that way quite as much as was predicted. With a few exceptions, like some of the work that you were doing, it didn't tend to work that well. Mm-hmm. Were actually a person who I thought was interestingly putting in a lot of the work that my, you know, peers in the experimental literary world didn't seem willing to put in to actually make their own ideas evolve like in the way that they wanted them to. So I always thought it was a really interesting, weird development.
Yeah, I think there's a distinction between, it's almost like a proof of concept and a work of art that fits there. Because I also pay very close attention to that, to comics in hyperspace and the directions that online comics could go in. And a lot of it was built around this idea of potential. Like, we could do this. Why? We have an infinite canvas. We'd be scrolling in two-dimensional space all over the place. We can do branching. But without a reason for that, it's just, I don't want to say a solution in search of a problem, but it feels like we need to have a reason to be doing this, because branching is expensive. It's expensive to build. It's expensive to print. You're duplicating stuff. Like, whenever you're dealing with a branching narrative, you have to, those stories have to tell a story together. What I guess I call them the meta story or the hyper story, because it's an illusion. The whole thing is a trick, right? When you're doing a nonlinear story, the promise is you can do what you want in this story. The truth is you can only do things that I've chosen for you to do. You're always going to be in my story space. And so your role as the author is to make sure that all of that story space is worthwhile, because someone's going to be going through it. It can't just be a throwaway choice. So you're writing an awful lot to make a volume that feels like it lives up to the promise of what it says it can do. You have to follow the reader, but also it has to be worthwhile. It can't just be random. Otherwise, it's just, why am I reading this? It's just a bunch of stuff that happens.
My first book was a choosable path poetry book in which, you know, the kind of concept of the book was that machines have changed what it means to be human. And here's a bunch of poetic statements about this. And each, you know, line of the poems links numerically to another poem and so forth. So I had even a slim volume of like 50, 60 pages, you know, I found it incredibly difficult to write that book. I'm mapping it through and I'm starting to think of it like,
all
okay,
in your head.
Yeah. And then I'm laying out sheets of paper on the ground. I'm doing this very small scale too. And then of course I started to think about like, well, how would they break it? You know, how I could ever reward them for breaking it. You know, the way I structured it, there are pages you would never read if you followed the path. And there's also, you would never finish. There's no terminal position.
Right.
But even like something as simple as what I was doing, I mean, I was at the time getting more credit than I think I should have in some ways for how difficult it really was. But even so, it was quite difficult. And I remember you setting these updates at one point during the Kickstarter, the development of that book. I remember you basically explaining at some point in these emails, like, okay, this is a lot harder than I thought it was going to be. And, you know, here's some of the problems I'm getting into. Yeah. But it was, you know, it turned out excellently. So how did that kind of move you towards comics? Because, I mean, up to that point, yes, you'd done web comics, but really it was a very text-based, you're swapping out the text every week, like what you're writing.
Writer-heavy.
Mm-hmm. And so on one hand, yes, you're working comics, but on the other hand, it's very... it's not a traditional comics in many most respects.
Yeah.
And then when you move into the Kickstarter success, I mean, what you had then, you've got these illustrated aspects of the book, but you're really in a prose work. Mm-hmm. And then after that point, you had done a number of anthologies. You were involved in the Machine of Death anthology, and there was other prose projects that you're involved in, and which you still do. You know, you've got nonfiction, you've got a really interesting approach to nonfiction, which might be worth getting into a little bit. But I'm curious to know, like, how you ended up kind of moving more fully into sort of traditional comics and working at Marvel as independently.
Yeah. So I do. I love comics. I love prose. My nonfiction, like How to Take Over the World, How to Make Everything. They're both these nonfictional cores around a candy coated fictional outer thing. Like How to Make Everything ideas. You've gone back and past. Your time machine's broken. How do you rebuild civilization? Here's a manual to do that. So it sort of motivates the nonfiction, but to get into comics, I've been asked this question before. People usually, it's like, I want to break into comics. How do you get a job at Marvel? And you know, my way is really slow. What I did was, I did Dinosaur Comics for myself for 10 years, and I still do today. Like, it's been 20 years last month, but around 10 years in, I thought I was just doing my funny talking dinosaur comic, and what I didn't realize was it kind of functioned as this resume. It's like, here's a guy who can meet a deadline, even a self-imposed deadline. Those are the hardest. Here's the kinds of jokes he likes. Here's his sense of humor. All the stuff you can get from just putting your work online. And after a decade, one of my readers, Shannon Waters, it turns out, had gotten a job at a comic book company called Boom, and they wanted someone to write the Adventure Time comic. And she said, why don't I email the Dinosaur Comics guy and see if he's interested? And so my career owes itself to me writing back that email and saying, yes, I would like to write an Adventure Time comic. I love the show. And there's a direct line between that and my editor at Marvel, Will Moss, reading the comic and thinking, this guy's interesting. I'll give him a talk about Squirrel Girl. Squirrel Girl leads to all sorts of stuff, including now Fantastic Four. But it's all a path with like a direct chain of breadcrumbs to me putting up Talking Dinosaurs with the same six pictures where the pictures don't change, but the words do. So if you've got 10 years to spend doing your own stuff, that is a way to get into Marvel. Wait till your readers grow up to get jobs around these comics companies. But the core of it, I think, is, and I believe this is valuable for anyone in a creative work, is it's really worthwhile to do your own stuff, to put out there where people can see it. Like I say, it shows what you can do. It shows what you're interested in. And while you're doing that, you're getting practice. Like, I would not have been able to write a comic like Adventure Time, my first traditionally published comic, monthly comic book, if I hadn't been writing comics for 10 years. Like, I would, you need the practice. You need to practice the craft. And if you're lucky, you can attract an audience while you're doing that, saying, hey, this is, I'd like to see more of this stuff. So it's a very frustrating answer. I know people say, how do I get a job at Marvel? And I say, publish your own stuff online and then see what happens. But I mean, it's worked for me, and I've seen it work a lot for other people, because nobody gets to write Spider-Man as their first job. Anyone in charge of Spider-Man wants to give it to someone who's they feel safe about. They feel there's no question marks around them. So you're going to have to do other stuff first. Why not make it your own stuff? Something you enjoy.
One thing I always notice if I'm on any situation where somebody is asked that kind of a question, like, how do I break in, in some form? And especially if they're talking to somebody who's very established, it's always interesting to me how vague the answers get, because at a certain point, what often people ask that question don't realize is that if you haven't already done it on a certain level, there's nothing they can do for you. Like, there's nothing that the editor of Spider-Man can do for you if you haven't been writing comics for 10 years, like, on a certain level. It's not entirely true, but in many ways it is true.
Yeah. You know? And, you know, it would be irresponsible for the editor in charge of Spider-Man to give it to someone they just met who has no credits. Like, it's just, you don't know them. They want to feel safe with the person they're giving it to. So you got to be able to do your own stuff, to publish your own work. And comics is especially hard because it's a visual medium. And if you're a comics writer, you need to find someone who wants to draw your work. And that's hard. That can mean you do photo comics like my friends Emily and Joey from A Softer World. You can do stick figures like Randy Monroe from SKCD. You can pay someone to draw your work. You can just start drawing yourself. One Punch Man, the initial artist, was the writer. It was really bad drawings. He admits it himself. But it grows from that. Like, there's no way around it that if you want to work in a visual medium, you can't just ignore that part. You can't just expect an artist to want to draw it for you for free. You've got to make it interesting.
Although people do expect that. One thing that I'm curious about, though, is, like, I know with the way you say that, it sounds somewhat clean, like you're moving from this to this to this. Mm-hmm. But in reality, though, once you land on Squirrel Girl, you're immediately out of the gate with, like, issue one of Squirrel Girl doing some very unusual things. So as a simple example, you're writing in the gutters. And yes. I'm curious to know, like, how you got an editor on board with doing something so unusual in a first issue, having not worked really, like, you'd worked in comics, but you hadn't worked there.
Yeah. Well, the pitch was I wanted to be an all ages book, which means it's for everyone. It's for kids, it's for adults. Everyone keeps their clothes on. Nobody swears. That's how you write all ages. And monthly comics, which this was going to be, is a not inexpensive hobby. The books are $4, $5. And I said, look, this is a comedy book. People get their money's worth if we literally put jokes in the margins. And what I realized a few issues into that, is that it also was great plot scaffolding in a shared universe like the Marvel Universe, because, you know, I would write a story with Captain America in it, and they'd say, just so you know, in the Captain America book right now, and this Squirrel Girl book comes out 3 months down the road, Captain America is going to be an old man with a super soldier serum sucked out of him with no powers. And I said, okay, that would be a roadblock in a normal comic, because you'd have to address it and have the characters say, like, as you know, Captain America, you've had the super soldier serum sucked out of you. But I could just make a joke about it at the bottom of the page, and we were done. We were off to the races. And the Deadpool card she has in the book, where one panel where it was basically, she had these trading cards, Squirrel Girl, the character, had these trading cards that told her what the enemy's origins, powers, weaknesses, everything about them, a little trading card. You put that trading card in a panel, you're basically turning to the audience saying, here's this guy's deal. Here's what he wants. Here's what he can do. Done. And we're off to the race. It was such an efficient way to sort of onboard people into this shared universe where they didn't need to know everything, because the book would tell them what they needed in this really natural way. And the secret there was, I didn't know a lot of this stuff. I didn't know most of this stuff. The first people Doreen fights in Squirrel Girl were people who had been in Marvel movies, because that was my main source of knowledge.
I mean, what I thought was so clever about it, in addition to everything you're saying, is it also has, I mean, as you say, like, who can know all of it?
Yeah.
Like, who can know all of it? Like, you have Kraven in that issue. I think it's the first issue.
First issue is Kraven, yeah.
Yeah. And like, who can keep track of whether Kraven is dead or alive, or, you know, like, it's just impossible. And that's true for characters like Kraven, who aren't even utilized heavily and extensively. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly true of Spider-Man. Like, how many Spider-Mans are there? You know, like, it becomes very complex very fast. One of the things that I thought was so clever, over on the flip side of DC, Snyder had done this death metal thing recently. And the thematic idea in death metal is, look, nobody can keep track of these characters and what their timelines are. Let's just agree they're all equally valid timelines on a certain level. Your version of Batman is as good as any other versions. Batman, the fans can all love Batman and have different attitudes towards Batman. Mm-hmm. So I thought, like, you're not really doing the same thing, but it was a very elegant way to approach that problem of, like, how do we have a character here who's kind of part of this universe, but also sort of on the side in a certain way.
It's a problem of accessibility. It's, you want the book to be accessible to everyone, people who aren't hardcore readers, and saying, don't worry about it, works great. Saying, here's what you need to know, works great. But one of the big things in superhero comics, one of the defining things in superhero comics, is continuity. The idea that everything counts going back 60, 70, 80 years. And the truth is that that's not true. A lot of it doesn't count. We all ignore the stories we didn't like. The bad stories just get never mentioned again. The good ones get re-mentioned over and over and over. And so there's this fuzzy idea of what's real and what's not based on what's popular. That's always changing. It changes over time. And no one can keep track of that, so you have to find a way around it. Although there's one person, Douglas Woke, wrote a book called All the Marvels, where he read every single Marvel comic from Fantastic Four number one all the way forward. And he wrote a book about doing that, and it's an incredible book. Where it's like, this is a story. This is one story being told over years by multiple authors. Here's how it turned out. It's really neat.
Hmm. The other thing I thought was just simply a clever approach with those gutter things is it is almost the reverse, or the kind of interesting comedic complement to the thing that the editors will often do in Marvel and DC,
notes, you know,
like,
yeah,
the star, the editor's notes. I thought that so it's almost like, it's not an editor's note, but it has, like, almost a joke inversion function, like expanding the editor's note into the narrative in a weird sort of interesting way.
Yeah.
Because there is that meta break that is normal in comics, where you just kind of break out of the story and the editor tells you in a little jokey manner, like, oh, you should check out this other issue, you know?
Smiling Stan Lee says, check out Fantastic Four number 3 for the answer to that. Yeah, and functionally, structurally, it gave me another voice. You have the voice of the characters in the story, and they never broke the fourth wall. And then you have this voice underneath the comics that could sometimes be the main characters. It was sometimes Doreen's inner monologue, or it could just be me telling you a funny story about the creation of this page, or some third-party narrator. It could be anything. And it gave you this option as a writer that I wouldn't get inside the story itself.
Now, one of the things you've got out or coming out, I forget exactly where it's located, is the Squirrel Girl Omnibus.
Came out this week, yeah.
Yeah, so when we're talking, it's this week. By the time you hear this, it'll be out and ready to go. If it hasn't sold out, I guess you've got the. But it's like you've done over 1,000 pages of Squirrel Girl at this point.
1,616 pages.
How does that feel?
I mean, it's good. It took 5 years to write it all, so it took a while. It's interesting. It is a brick of a book. It's like you could seriously hurt someone with it, and my experience flipping through the book is remembering what it was like to make those pages of stories, where my life was like back then. So I have a very different experience from someone reading it, but even flipping through it, it gives you the sense of this is one story told over a long period of time, just like the Marvel Universe. And we were lucky in that usually creative teams on books don't last that long. They don't last 5 years. You'll have maybe a writer stick along, but the artist will change very often or whatever. But we got to keep it with just me and Erica, and then me and Derek, and Rico was a colorist the whole time. And it feels a lot like it is this cohesive narrative. You meet Doreen going to her first year undergrad. You leave with her finishing up her second year undergrad. The relationships develop over time. I'm so pleased that it reads as one narrative and not just a collection of short stories.
Sure. I think what's interesting also with Squirrel Girl is that it is a book that thematically, I think, is on some level about the Marvel Universe. Like, it has a sort of this weird meta position. Squirrel Girl as a character has a sort of interesting meta position as sort of this superhero that in a certain sense is ridiculous, beyond the normal ridiculousness of Marvel superheroes, and in a certain sense is incorporated fully into this universe, and yet is a sort of, in some ways, outside of the universe. Like, she sort of stands in this weird, interesting position. And in some respects, I feel like that character and the sort of world around that character is on a certain level like a meta story about what the Marvel universe is.
That's interesting. I mean, you look at the final issue of our run. It's basically Galactus returns from issue one. And he and Doreen have a conversation on the moon where he talks about how he's going to go away for a while, how they're both going to be going away, how he doesn't break the fourth wall, but he kind of leans against it, where he's talking about things will change, when we return won't be the same people, and that's fine. And it's a conversation about death. It's a conversation about saying goodbye. And it's a conversation to the readers, a lot of whom were younger readers who picked it up as their first comic, and saying, like, this is ending now. And that's sad, but it doesn't have to be sad. Like, there's something, we'll always be here, we'll always have this moment we share together here on the moon. And sorry, I still get emotional thinking about Squirrel Girl. It was nice that you could bring in this character of effectively space god Galactus and say, like, let's have a conversation about what it means to say goodbye to each other. And most superhero comics don't do that, don't get to do that. That was part of what made Doreen Green Squirrel Girl special, is that I decided she is going to be this clever young woman. And if she is a clever young woman who's smart and empathic and knows her stuff, then when she sees a bad guy, is the best use of her powers to punch them until they stop doing crime? That doesn't seem like that'll be her first stop. And so that is very natural for myself. I'm sure it's the same for you. You have more conversations than you do fist fights, but in superhero comics, it's always fist fight first. And so inside the Marvel Universe, it made her stand apart as someone who is different, maybe doesn't quite fit in quite the same way, but still belongs there. And I think that's the core of what you were saying, where she felt like she was part of it, but somehow aside from it, is that she isn't like the other heroes. You can't take a Squirrel Girl story and put Spider-Man into it, because they're different people who react with the universe in a different way. I mean, that's a joy as a writer, right? To be able to take this character and spend 5 years with her. When I was ending the book, it felt a lot like, imagine being a parent where you're seeing your kid go off to school, where you're like, I've done what I can. You're in someone else's hands now. I've given you hopefully all the tools you need, but now it's up to you. And I really enjoyed that part of it.
Now, before we get into your, you're not exclusive to Marvel. And so before we get into your newer book and your newer sort of indie work, I wonder if we could talk a little bit more about just some of your Marvel stuff. In particular, Fantastic Four. I mean, you've got Fantastic Four in the background there. And I'm curious to know, like, we were just talking before I started recording about one of the things I really liked in the first issue of Fantastic Four, in addition to just, you know, it being an interesting story. You had this interesting note at the end, because of course the way that those books work is the first issue, there's no letters to print in the letters page. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, sometimes that'll get filled in interesting ways. I think you filled it at one. I think if I remember right, Squirrel Girl, you filled it with fake letters.
Fake letters. Yeah. Who would win in a fight, common. Squirrel Girl or the Hulk?
Yeah. And then you also said they were fake letters. Sometimes I'm sure they're fake in other books without them telling you, but, in Fantastic Four, you did something a little unusual, which was you talked a little bit about your sort of core ideas from the sort of pitch that you had about your take on Fantastic Four. And I thought that was a really interesting way of kind of getting behind the curtain a little bit, and sort of in a way laying your gauntlet down.
Yeah, Fantastic Four is an interesting book because it has been running almost without interruption since the 60s. And it was crown jewel of Marvel's publishing at one point. And there are people alive today who have been reading that book since the 60s. And so with Squirrel Girl, I could show up and say, hey, here's a newish character. Here's our fresh take. Get in on the ground floor, everyone. This is a new thing. Get excited. With Fantastic Four, like, there's no way I'm going to show up some guy who is younger than the characters themselves in terms of how long they've been published and saying, hey, I'm the new guy. Everyone get on board with what I want to do. Like, it would just be disrespectful. And so I thought the best way to approach it was to be like, Fantastic Four are great. There's nothing wrong with these characters. They're terrific. Fantastic, even. And here's how I want to approach them. It's kind of calling your shot, kind of saying, these are the kind of stories I want to tell. And I think they fit nicely within who the Fantastic Four are. Every time you have a new writer in a book, the flavor of it changes slightly. Are they going to be doing a relationship soap opera? Are they going to be doing cosmic fate of the multiverse stories? I said, I want to do character focused, smaller stories. I want it to be four weirdos who roll into town and solve a problem for someone. Kind of like original series Star Trek. That's sort of like, there's a mystery. Let's solve it. Let's spread good. Let's be adventurers. And it was an unusual letters page for sure, but I feel like it helped me, and I think it sort of helped readers say, this is what I want to do. This is what you can look forward to.
I also think there's just a way in which I often advise when I teach writing that writers do similar things. I mean, it could always take different forms, but like where as quickly as possible, you sort of establish your contract with the audience in a certain
This is
level.
What it is. This is what it isn't. Here's what we're doing. Yeah.
And it, you know, there's positive and negative ways to phrase it. Like, you know, like, but you know, you kind of want to divide the audience in a certain level as quickly as possible, you know, into like, are you, you're in or you're out. And you know, not that you need to, now an example like that, you know, you're being respectful of the history of it, as opposed to, you know, if you're just starting your own thing, you might, you know, more quickly kind of make a division, mm-hmm. Or more, you know, heavily, kind of make the division.
Well, it's kind of what genre is, right? Like, mm-hmm. That was the thing with Fantastic Four, is they can be superheroes, they can be science adventurers, they can be soap opera, they can be all these different things, and have been all these different things over the past 80 years, that I was basically saying, this is the genre we're going to do. this is what we're doing. This is the box it fits into. There'll be things that don't quite fit in that box. There'll be aberrations that are far outside that box, but this is the thing we're aiming for. And so I saw it as sort of like the role of genre, where you say, what's this movie about? Oh, it's sci-fi. Okay, good. Then I know kind of what to expect. If you say it's a romantic comedy, I know kind of what to expect.
And also, this is what I'm preserving. This is what, you know, I'm carrying forward. This is the thing you can still count on me for. You know, I understand this, these characters, you know, this way that you do. So I thought it's an interesting, like, kind of transparency. I mean, it is still a letter. It's almost like sort of your letter to everyone else, as before they start sending letters to you. Yeah. I thought it was a very clever approach.
It's a neat situation to be in, right? I don't think there's a ton of examples of long running serials like that, where just some freelancer will start writing them. I certainly never encountered situations like that before where suddenly you're the guy in charge of this. And on one hand, it's just a comic book. On the other hand, the movies based on these characters drive billions of dollars in culture and are one of the major things in the world today. So it's, I guess what I'm saying is I'm aware of, there it is, the great power and the great responsibility that comes with these characters.
What's the hardest thing about writing those books and working, you know, for comics at that level?
I was going to say coming up with the ideas for Fantastic Four, because they are these standalone. I want every issue to be generally standalone. I've bent that a couple times. There's a two-parter, but I wanted to feel like they're going on an adventure. They find the weird thing. They fix the weird thing. They make the world a better place in a single issue. And I will tell you, that is really hard to do. With Squirrel Girl, I did 4-issue arcs, which meant I had to plot out a story once every 4 months, once every 5 months, really. With the task force every month. And so the workload is about twice what Squirrel Girl was. The pay is the same, but I think that's what the characters need. And I think that's what fits the book. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Now, in terms of your non-Marvel work, you've got a new book out. I believe it's going to be out by the time this airs.
April 4th is when it comes out.
Yes. So, and it's called Danger and Other Unknown Risks. So this is a graphic novel. Can you talk a bit about the premise of that book? And I don't know how much deeply you want to get into it. I've read the whole thing, but I don't want to be spoiling it too much. So I'd rather you kind of set the
I don't want to spoil it, premise. It has like a plot thing. But so it's Danger and Other Unknown Risks. It's a book that I made with Erica Henderson, my artist on Squirrel Girl. And it is a story about a young woman named Marguerite and her talking dog, a little boy dog named Daisy. And they're on a quest to save the world in the year 1999, December 31st, New Year's Eve. Instead of Y2K, magic came back to the world catastrophically. Things got really bad really quick. And now it's decades later, and she's on a quest from her uncle to save the world and bring it back to the way it once was. And I feel like that's about as much as I can say without getting too much into spoilers, except for, like, there's a lot of stuff going on and there's more than it seems, et cetera, et cetera. But it is a something I'm really proud of in a way that I don't normally, as a naturally modest Canadian, get to talk about. I had the same thing with I did a graphic novel adaptation of Slaughterhouse-Five, where I had Albert Montes and Kurt Vonnegut writing it. And I just imagined I was the editor, and I'd commissioned Kurt Vonnegut to give me a graphic novel. And he gives me this novel. And I'm like, Kurt, you messed up. I gotta fix it. And when that book came out, I could look at it and like, this is really great, because I didn't feel like it was my book. It didn't feel like I was the guy writing. I had a finger on the wheel. Kurt was there. The artist was there. With Danger, Erica and I collaborated on writing the book together too. And so I look at this and there's stuff that is the best of me, the best of Erica. And I feel like when I say, this is a really great book, I'm not talking myself up. I'm talking this imaginary Ryerica person up that is somehow distinct from me. But it's a really fun all ages adventure, exploring the idea of heroism and destiny and chosen oneness and all that good stuff.
It also kind of explores, in a weird way, generational divides and these different sort of attitudes on particular things. Again, without getting too deeply into it, ruining any plot moments, it might be hard to discuss, but I'm curious to know if there's any way that you were kind of thinking about sort of the social political climate these days. The book's not political in any obvious manner, but you know, I certainly could maybe see like that thematic idea in the background.
Yeah, we talked a lot about of all that stuff, of what we owe our children, what we owe past generations, who gets to control the levers of power, what that means. The fun origin story of the book is that Erica had a contract to do a book with another writer. And this writer just didn't turn in a script for 3 years, which I didn't realize was an option. And so she was like, hey, Ryan, do you want to write a book for me? Let's do a book together. And so unlike how this normally goes, where you have to have a pitch that gets approved and then they publish it, this was the one time, probably the only time in my life, where everyone was already on board. The publisher had a contract with Erica. So it was just do whatever you want and we'll publish it. And so we pitched, if I remember correctly, a collection of short stories. And they said, sure, sounds great. After like a half hour Zoom call, we went off and just talked and talked about what interests us and what we liked. And Erica reminded me that every sort of premise she pitched, I would say, yes, and there is a talking dog as a joke, as a fun bit we were doing. And then eventually she's like, you know what, you clearly want to have a talking dog. Let's put a talking dog in this. So that was like the first thing we nailed down about the story we wanted to tell. But everything else came out of long conversation on the phone of what we like and don't like in stories and what interests us and what we're frustrated by, and sort of mixing that all up in a pot, you know, in a young adult adventure story pot and letting it bake.
Why was the talking dog so important to you?
I think my main idea, I don't remember particularly why, except I can tell you now, I think it's fun. I love a talking dog. One of the joys of comics, and artists will, Erica will probably push back on this, but one of the joys of comics is that it costs about the same to have a person standing there in a room on Earth or to have an alien standing there on a room on a planet 30,000 light years away. And so in a movie, you don't get a talking dog unless that is built into the budget. In a comics, you can just say, I'm standing here and I want a talking dog, and we can put it in. So it's kind of an, I guess that sense, playing to the strengths of the medium, where we know it's going to be a comic. Let's do some stuff that we can maybe not only do in comics, but do really well in comics. We can give a dog a personality and make you believe it's speaking just like any other character. So let's do it. There's no uncanny valley. It's going to be great.
There's no uncanny valley. It's going to be great.
Well, there's not in comics, right? Like, it's
not in that style, especially. Yeah.
Yeah. But in live action, I've never seen a credible talking dog. I've seen credible talking puppets who look like dogs, but puppets dance around the uncanny valley. But like a realistic talking dog, humans do not have the power yet, sadly beyond our grasp.
One day,
God willing, in the creek door.
Is that your next project? Getting a talking dog going in reality?
Yeah, why not? I certainly have the skills for that.
You're building them. This has been so wonderful talking to you, Ryan. Let's just, you know, take a moment to appreciate how cool everything you're doing is. You know, you just have like the coolest career in the world. You know,
it's I'm very aware of how unlikely it is. It really brings joy to my heart when, you know, Danger comes out, or Fantastic Four comes out, or even Squirrel Girl comes out, and people say, "Oh, is that the Dinosaur Comics guy? The Dinosaur Comics guy is writing Fantastic Four. Like, what? How? What happens here? Where's the missing connective tissue there?" And I know, like, some people don't like being known through their work. I know Scott Adams hates being called the Dilbert guy. I will always call him the Dilbert guy because that is what he is. Like, I'm happy to be known as a Dinosaur Comics guy, or the Squirrel Girl guy, or the Fantastic Four guy, the Danger and Other Unknown Risk guy. Like, I don't mind being summed up by one piece of my work, because that's the piece that connected with you, right? Like, if that's a piece that really made an impact on you, then yeah, awesome. Like, I'm not gonna denounce that or deny it. I think that's terrific. And as a writer nowadays, 2023, I don't know how they did it in the past, but I really am sustained by nice notes people send me, a nice letter on Twitter, just like, I read this, I liked it, you're great. It's praise, and obviously everyone likes praise, but it's also like, it's nice. No one had to send me those notes. And I like when they do. It sort of restores my faith in humanity through passing along comments. I try to do it myself too. When I see something I love, just to drop the line, be like, this was great. Good work.
Thanks so much for talking to me, Ryan. And where can people go to find, what's the best place to kind of find out what you're up to these days?
Yeah. If you go to ryannorth.ca, because I'm Canadian, I have my little personal website there with a link to, I think, everything I've written, going all the way back to my master's, to my undergrad honors thesis. So including comics, I have this great flex where it's like, besides science fiction, I've written actual science. Here are some research papers I'm credited on. So ryannorth.ca, and you can find me on Twitter at ryanqnorth for as long as Twitter lasts. The next few weeks.
The next few weeks at least. Thanks again so much for talking to me, and
my pleasure.
Keep writing the wrong way.